Welcome to A Cult of Personality, Esoteric Podcast Extraordinaire at occultofpersonality.net. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and your co-host is Rudolph Berger. A Cult of Personality podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, Stitcher Radio, Acast, TuneIn, Google Play, and all the best podcast apps. This is episode number 185, featuring an interview with scholar Christian Giudice to discuss occultism and traditionalism in 20th century Italy. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the Chamber of Reflection at chamberofreflection.com, our membership site, as well as all of our patrons who participate via the A Cult of Personality Patreon campaign at patreon.com/A Cult of Personality. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. Temple of Thelema is a true outer order of the greater mysteries, providing ceremonial initiation, structure training, and regular group work, all in conformity with the principles of the Book of the Law. An investment of time, effort, and commitment is expected from each member. Each is expected to aspire fervently to the great work, to dare with courage undaunted, to perfect that work, and ever to apply his or her best effort to effect harmony within the order and within the world in general. Founded in service to the AA, College of Thelema seeks to guide the student to an understanding of the Law of Thelema. Most especially, this means a deeper understanding of oneself and of one's true will. A combination of instruction techniques is employed, including seminars, written texts, and individual work. For over 40 years, College of Thelema has published journals in The Continuum and Black Pearl, as well as several books on occult subjects, maintaining high standards in Thelemic education. Visit Temple of Thelema at www.thelema.org. Anathema Publishing Limited. Quality occult books and contemporary esoterica. Established in 2011, Anathema Publishing aims to provide superior literature in content and form by creating a trinosophic relationship in troth and gabo between publisher, author, and reader. Anathema Publishing produces refined books for the true bibliophile on topics ranging from Gnosticism, traditional craft, alchemy, hermeticism, witchcraft, to Luciferian theosophy. www.anathemapublishing.com. Now, in episode number 185, Christian Giudice joins us to discuss his doctoral dissertation entitled Occultism and Traditionalism, Arturo Reggini and the Anti-Modern Reaction in Early 20th Century Italy. Christian Giudice is a PhD scholar at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. His thesis analyzes the interaction between modernity and its impact on the occult milieu of early 20th century Italy, focusing on Arturo Righini as a case study. Righini was actively involved in most of the occult manifestations on the Italian peninsula during his lifetime. Thus, he represents a fundamental figure if we want to better understand the convoluted period leading up to the Great War and the rise of Benito Mussolini. Giudice's work is crucial to understanding the contextual landscape between the various competing groups of people who endorsed ideologies of occultism, traditionalism, elitism, Catholicism, and those that endorse the views of modernism, and those that endorse the views of fascism. One of the major takeaways from Christian's work is that occultists and those interested in esotericism generally have tended to be intellectual elitists and more traditional rather than progressive. And for a variety of reasons, this is not necessarily the case in our times now. Christian Giudice, welcome to A Cult of Personality podcast. It's a pleasure to finally speak with you this evening.
Pleasure is mine, Greg. Pleasure is mine.
Good evening.
Yeah, it's, and we very much enjoyed reading your manuscript, so that we're going to be speaking about. It's really quite tremendous piece of scholarship, I have to say. Occultism and Traditionalism, Arturo Righini and the Anti-Modern Reaction in Early 20th Century Italy. But before we get into speaking about your work, maybe you could give listeners a little bit of a background and a bio if they're not already familiar with you.
Sure. I'll probably give two bios in parallel, like my academic career and my interest in Western esotericism, which kind of then tend to converge into the same point. I obtained a BA at Oxford University in classics. I've always been interested in the classics and still am to a certain extent, and then proceeded to get an MA at Exeter University, where the late professor Nicholas Goodrich Clark had a program on Western esotericism. And those were two fantastic years, which really kind of convinced me to pursue Western esotericism as an academic career. I was fortunate enough to obtain a position at the University of Gothenburg, supervised by Professor Henrik Bogdan. And yeah, the rest, more or less academically speaking, is history. We started thinking on what was really needed in the academic milieu with regards to Western esotericism. I started thinking of all the authors that I'd read when I was younger, such as Righini, such as Evola, which are obviously Italian, and I'm half Italian. And there's almost nothing about these authors in the English language, and that is such a shame. And what is there? The stuff that is there and that's out there is usually seen in a certain way, mostly because, I guess, of Evola's political ideas. So what I wanted to do with this dissertation and the 4 years of research related to this dissertation was to try and observe and research things with a neutral eye, you know, with an attitude that wasn't damning from the beginning, because it seems to me at the moment that any work on traditionalism per se is really accepted with suspicion, both within academia and without. I'm not sure if you agree with me there, Greg.
No, I think I would agree with you there very much.
And to go to a more kind of intellectual biography, I started being interested in occult, as in the French fin de siècle occult, from a very early age. I guess it was through the decadent poets that I got into pretty early, more or less same age as everyone else gets into them, you know, 15, 16. And I always kept coming over the same names as an inspiration, the same occult thinkers, as an inspiration for these poets and authors, such as Papus, such as Yves Saint-Alvedre, and others. So I guess my first foray into the world of occultism was reading these French authors, and which kind of brought me to think, okay, you know, if they're French authors, there must be Italian authors who at the same time probably tackle the same subjects. That's when I got to Evola and to Reghini and to Giuliano Kremertz, who I guess are the three leading figures of 20th century Italian occultism. At the same time, around about the age of 1820, I obviously got into the end of the century British occult revival with the Golden Dawn and Aleister Crowley and his works. And I guess that's a completely different kettle of fish, but it kind of opened my eyes to the awareness of a global phenomenon that was going on at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, which was this occult revival, which kind of then dealt with the whole Weberian idea of disenchantment, if you see what I mean.
Mm, certainly.
It's very interesting. Before we go into the book and the subject of the book more deeply, you are an academic, and the academic milieu and esotericism sometimes are seen by both sides, actually, by some academics and by some esotericists, like something incompatible. On the other hand, there are now more and more universities who finally open again, we should say, to the esotericism, to the occult. How do you personally see that? Why does that happen again now? And, or am I completely wrong with my assumption?
I don't think you're completely wrong. I think you're actually right. There is more and more interest towards an academic understanding of occultism, even contemporary occultism. There was a splendid conference organized in 2012 in Stockholm called Contemporary Occultism. And there's so many panels in contemporary conferences that deal with occultists that are alive today. So I think that after the war, after the Second World War, there was a whole idea of occultism, and I tackle that subject in my thesis, mainly derived from the Frankfurt School and Theodor Adorno especially, whereby occultism was seen really in connection with irrationalism and inevitably, according to these thinkers, brought to totalitarianism. Hence the problem of studying this subject in a serious manner in academia. If something was deemed to be irrational and to lead to totalitarian ideas, then why would someone want to study it from an academic standpoint? I think that was kind of the main question until the 90s. And then, of course, we have Antoine Fevre and Wouter Hanegraaff in the 90s who kind of gave the whole field more respectability and through theoretical frameworks made it so that Western esotericism could be studied in a ethic, in a scientific way, without giving way to personal ideas or practitioner ideas within writing and within thinking Western esotericism.
Right, yeah.
I guess as an academic in the Western esoteric milieu, I guess I'm very lucky to be at the right place and at the right time, really, because until 20 years ago, there wasn't really much to go for in terms of positions and in terms of interest for funding or in terms of even interest in the outside world. Practitioners would read practitioners' works and academics would read academics' works. So I think it's a very, very healthy and new and exciting moment within the academic world. And Western esotericism is definitely more accessible to both academics and to the general public when addressed through the lenses of academia.
That is very interesting. I'm tempted to ask you more questions about that, but I kind of want to talk to you more about your work. So maybe we'll circle back around to that a little bit
later.
Sure. Maybe we can get into it a little bit. What can you tell us about Arturo Reghini? Who was he? Why do you find him a compelling figure? Enough to base your dissertation on him and his writings.
Well, Arturo Reghini is, once you really get to see the whole picture, he's a really incredible figure. He's a son of his age. He was born in 1878, so he was really kind of coming of age in the very early 20th century. And as far as Italian history and Italian politics and Italian society go, he really went through all the stages of those first 25 years of Italian culture. He obtained a degree in mathematics at one of the best universities in Italy for scientific subjects, which was Pisa University. He was born in Florence. He was first and foremost interested in mathematics. And of course, he was also very interested in literary milieu of his day. And the literary milieu of his day is pretty explosive if analyzed in depth. Because on the one side, you have the Florentine avant-garde of people like Papini and Prezzolini, who want to really break away from Italian culture as it was in the end of the 19th century. And on the other side, you have the budding futurist movement. You know, the futurist movement is probably better known outside of the Italian borders. And he kind of straddled both movements. He was friends with both of the most interesting people belonging to these two movements. He was also a member, an early member, of the Theosophical Society in Italy. For a while, he was actually the head librarian of the Theosophical Library in Florence. So you get this philosophical standpoint of like neo-idealism from Papini and Prezzolini and their journals. And you get this kind of new Sturm und Drang futurist input from Marinetti and his followers. But at the same time, from a very, very young age, even before the age of 20, you see Righini being interested in the occult and in Freemasonry. And that is, I think, a very, very particular mix. It kind of joins together all phases of Italian culture in one person. And so the choice of Arturo Righini was kind of natural, really, because it could allow me to talk about the person, thus write what you could call an intellectual biography, which is what I consider my dissertation to be. But at the same time, you can, by analyzing the different influences and the different facets of his personality, you can also look at the wider milieus which were blossoming in early 20th century Italy. So to answer your question, I mean, Arturo Righini really embodies the youth of early 20th century Italy. And it's a very particular kind of youth. I mean, it's an aristocratic youth. It's an elitist youth. It's a youth that met around cafes in Florence and in Rome. So it's very much la creme de la creme of thinkers of the time. And Arturo Righini has the luck of being right in the middle of all this in his late teens. So analyzing his writings is really kind of having an open window onto what was going on and what was really happening within the Italian intellectual and, I guess, occultist milieu.
From hearing you speak, it's interesting to become aware how little we know about that period in Italy, about how people were thinking, especially in the occult or esoteric circles. We seem to know much more about Germany, England, France, you mentioned, and Italy, even though when you dig a bit, had a very rich occult esoteric life. But why do you think that period, without going now into the detail of why that happened later on, but why even at that time Europe was not so much aware of what was going on in Italy?
It's a very good question, which would really deserve more than one answer, really. And I think we can start with the whole theoretical framework of my dissertation, which really discusses the idea of the possibility of multiple modernities. This was a theory put forward by a scholar called Eisenstadt, where he said that there wasn't one modernity in Europe. So modernity didn't happen in the same way in all European countries. Some countries had an industrial revolution happening later, so they really got into the modern era a bit more unprepared and a bit later than other countries. And Italy was definitely the case. Italy was definitely behind most European countries when it comes to industrialization, when it comes to literacy percentages within the country, and also in the number of people interested with things like, you know, Hegelian neo-idealism or occultism or art avant-gardes. I mean, you can really count these people on the fingers of your hands. I mean, we're not talking of huge milieus. We're talking about very, very few people who would meet up because there weren't that many people who could understand the needs of what I define as an elite in my work. Another answer could be possibly that, well, apart from the language barrier, of course, you don't have many scholars dealing with Italian esotericism because, of course, not many scholars have Italian as a language. And sure. French and English are obviously languages that are much easier to find amongst works published. But even amongst those who did have Italian as a language, and I'm thinking of scholars like Eugenio Guérin or Paul Oscar Cristella, first half of the 20th century scholars of what we now would call Western esotericism, well, they would focus on the Renaissance period, which undoubtedly is the most important when it comes to the output and the influence it had within the Italian peninsula. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt in any scholar's mind that the influence that Ficino or Pico della Mirandola had on later esotericists is much bigger than the legacy left by occultists like Reghini or Evola or Kremert. So people who had that chance, they would definitely go back to more, I would say, noble and accepted periods of esotericism, which the Renaissance definitely is. And I don't find any fault with that. I mean, it's great that there have been people before us who have treated those periods so thoroughly that we are allowed to stand on their shoulders, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants, and take care of the more recent periods in Italian occult history. I'm not sure that fully answers your question. Oh,
absolutely, and especially that you take different approaches to the answer, I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I would agree, that is interesting. Curious how you would describe Reghini's conception, if I'm describing this accurately, of a continuous esoteric Roman tradition, and I'm wondering how accurate you think his assessment was.
Sure. To start with, I think it's fair to say that the idea of an unbroken chain of initiates, such as that posited by Reghini and by his mentor and his followers, is not a new one. I mean, if we read, for example, Jocelyn Godwin's The Golden Thread, or if we read any traditionalist thinker like Guénon or Evola, we have this idea of an unbroken chain of initiates which have passed down the knowledge, you know, from person to person individually. We get that in Kabbalah as well, which Kabbalah in Hebrew means tradition, means mm-hmm. passing down, means transmitting. So it's not only a Western thing, it also applies to the Middle East and to the Hebrew Kabbalah, for example. I think this idea has always been very tempting for occultists, A, as a form of self-justification, in the way that, okay, I believe in this because 2,000 years ago, this tradition started and it never ended. Or at the beginning of time, with Adam and Eve, this tradition started and it never ended. And on the other hand, it's also very easy for these people to actually justify their actions and their writings, because behind them they have an eternity of adepts who have come before them, who have thought exactly the same things and have practiced exactly the same rituals as, for example, Reghini has. Of course, with Reghini, we're talking about him wanting to harken back to ancient Roman times and fight against the modern world with paganism and with the mores of the ancient Romans. So, and with Pythagoras' teachings, those are the two main influences. But I mean, you get that with every other esoteric tradition. I mean, it's intrinsic in the idea of esoteric tradition that there is this unbroken golden chain, as Godwin puts it. I guess they were just working in a framework that had existed for a long time, even before they started working with it. There's a very interesting book by a scholar called Olaf Hammer called Claiming Knowledge, and it's a book on the various strategies of epistemology. And one of the main strategies of epistemology, of gaining knowledge, but also of justifying knowledge, is that of creating a tradition. And, well, when you ask me, was he on the mark or was he off the mark? I can't really give you a straight answer to that, because I really don't know. But what I do know is that that is a classic strategy of legitimization of knowledge within the Western esoteric milieus throughout the ages and throughout geographical spaces in all of Europe. So it's nothing new and it's nothing shocking. That I can say.
It's like even Reverend Anderson, when he created his Constitutions of Freemasonry, the whole first part is talking about the heritage coming down the ages.
Exactly.
Or if you think about Martinus de Pasqua, I mean, we're talking late 1600s, 1700s. If you know, Martinism before it becomes Martinism, we're talking about someone who wrote a book on the reintegration of beings, and it all starts from the fall of man. And after that, everything is a consequence of the fall of man. I think the difference is only where you posit the fall of man. And where Ruggini posits the fall of man is when the Roman Empire accepted Christianity as its religion. And therefore, it lost its local tradition and its sense of closeness to the geographical earth, which had propelled the Roman Empire to become what it was. So really, I mean, there isn't that much of a difference. It's only really kind of choosing a starting point where things start going badly. It's very, very similar to Ganon's idea. Well, Ganon's, I mean, the Hindus' idea of the Yugas, which Ganon picks up on. And, of course, Evola picks up on. So everything is kind of slowly becoming worse and worse and worse in this kind of cyclical time. And at one point or another, things will get so bad that there has to be a palingenesis. There has to be a return to the golden age. And I guess that Ruggini's golden age is ancient Rome.
It's reminiscent of Pico too, and is in the oration a little bit too.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm confident that Ruggini had a very, very good knowledge about Renaissance Hermeticism. He actually translated Agrippa's books on the Occulta Philosophia and a 120-page introduction to the Occulta Philosophia. And I think it's one of his best works in the total of his bibliography. I think that introduction really shows how much this 20th century man really kind of resonates with ideas that have come way before him. And yet, I mean, Pico is definitely one of those greats to whom Ruggini looks back to. And so is Agrippa, absolutely.
Fascinating.
And even the Renaissance idea was kind also of creating an intellectual tradition again at that point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the greatest ideas, more stimulating ideas that I have found in these 4 years of research has been that of fighting the modern world by creating an intellectual elite. And if you think about it, when Lorenzo de' Medici gives Marsilio Ficino, he was translating Plato at the time, and Lorenzo de' Medici was already quite old and close to his dying days. And once he got his hand on the Hermetica, he stopped Ficino and said, no, translate these. I really want to read them before I die. And so you have this idea of there is an intellectual elite, and there are certain works or certain ideas that deserve to be preserved and handed down. And Plato, yes, is very important, but the Hermetica, even in Renaissance times, even for someone like Lorenzo de' Medici, were definitely more important because they were considered to convey a much older truth. And the older the truth, the more valid and the more important it was. And I think that was kind of what really brought Ganon and Ruggini together, but maybe we'll get to that later.
I don't know if I interpret you well. Please correct me if I don't. But if I understand you well, the Ruggini and others in that small circle were more of a noble descent, one could say. At least they were very elitist within their own society group. And the connection between, we come to that a bit later probably, but fascism and occultism later on, or be it the connection or be it a connection that was made up, also existed in Germany. But there, we have the impression today, this was more plebeic, let's call it that, movement there, as opposed to this more elitist noble movement in Italy. Am I right about that? If so, why?
I think that like fascism as a movement and in the way that it reacted towards the intellectual elites, it was in every way as populistic as the Nazi regime was, to be honest. I mean, Mussolini was very, very wary about Freemasonry, not because Freemasonry wielded this incredible power that could subvert the status quo, but because they met in secret and because they shared knowledge that he was not privy to or couldn't understand or wouldn't want to understand. So in that sense, I think that there isn't much difference between 1933 in Germany and 1929 in Italy. I really don't think there is that much difference. I mean, both regimes really did not like the idea of intellectual elites outside of fascism and outside of Nazism. Most of Righini's followers and Righini's mentor, Armentano, they had to leave the country when they realized that their, you know, their dream of this intellectual elite was not working. Righini was one of the very, very few who stayed, and he had to pay for that because he really couldn't get a job after 1929, and he couldn't really work. He was a maths teacher, of course, and he couldn't teach in any public, so fascist-run school or university or anything because he was an ex-Mason. So I think that when it comes to the totalitarian regimes, that's what I really don't get with the idea that Adorno had of occultism leading to rationalism, then leading to totalitarianism. I don't think there is a consecutio between occult circles and irrationalism and then fascism. I think it's two distinct things that happened more or less at the same time. Well, occult circles were there even way before and way after. What I think that is really, really singular of early 20th century, and the case could be made for Germany in early 20th century. In fact, Corinna Tritell has made this case in her book Science for the Soul. The case could be made for England. The case could be made for France. There were many, many elites, intellectual elites. What has happened, though, is that academic scholarship has tried to, I don't know if whitewash is the best term to use, but let's stick to that, has tried to whitewash occultism and has tried to make it acceptable to today's standards. So there's a plethora of articles and books and presentations on how occultism was progressive, on how occultism sowed the first seeds of feminism, or nurtured the first feminist ideals, of how occultism was pro-democratic in some sense. And I don't think it was, to be honest. I don't think it was anywhere. But since, I mean, that would have been a massive undertaking to prove that it wasn't in all of Europe, I just tried to prove the point that it wasn't at least in one country and tried to give the reason why it wasn't, at least in this country. And that goes back to the whole idea of Italy being a bit behind compared to all other countries, and so still having a very small, small nucleus of rich people versus a very, very large mass of uneducated and illiterate people. The difference was much more striking in Italy, I guess, than it was abroad. But I still don't buy into the whole theory of occultism as progressive, at least at the beginning of the 20th century, in any of European countries, to be honest.
It's fascinating. You just actually answered the question I was going to ask you. So, and I would agree with your assessment, by the way. I think my impression of that argument about the progressive nature of occultism and esotericism is more simultaneous with the Spanish Inquisition and the creation of Christian Kabbalism. Mm-hmm. Where in that period of time, I would say you had some progressive philosophies that were kind of blossoming for various reasons. But I would agree with you completely. The 20th century doesn't seem that way at all. So I guess what I want to ask you is, how would you characterize the essential criticism of modernism that was expounded by these Roman traditionalists, if you will?
Sure. I guess that, I mean, it's something really that can be extended to other thinkers of the time. I would not call Evelot Roman traditionalist, although he did have his ancient Roman phase as well. I think I would extend it to all traditionalist thinkers of the time. And they really feel this, they really feel modernity in a very acute way. And they really feel it as something that is disrupting life as it was before. And as we've argued before, when this early age was, you know, changes from philosopher to philosopher, from thinker to thinker. But what people had in common was basically the idea that the industrialization of cities, the fact that people were leaving the countryside in masses to go to the city. I mean, the whole everything that characterizes modernity as we know it. I think that most of the thinkers that I – well, all of the thinkers really that I touch upon feel that as the most acute rupture with the past and with something that was harmonious and that is now very cacophonous. If we want to stay with the cacophony and the traditionalist thinking, one anecdote that comes to mind is Julius Evola when he's writing about in Metaphysics of the Peaks, I think it's been translated in English. It's a collection of essays on mountain climbing as a metaphor for spiritual ascension. And of course, Evola was a mountain climber, and I guess many people acquainted to the Occult Personality podcast know very well that Crowley was a great mountain climber as well. So, I mean, there's not only, you know, one isolated person interested in esotericism that has made this connection. And Evola at one point writes, I mean, it's a very minute detail, but it gives you the idea. He writes about how going to the mountainside in his days and in the 1920s was not the same anymore, because every weekend people would come and they would ski and they would leave all the litter. And instead of traditional music that was still preserved in these isolated places, they would bring their records and play jazz. And to Evola, this was like, it just drove him mad, the fact that people could come and desecrate the mountainside in this way. So I think if we kind of broaden this very, very small anecdote that I picked from the Metafisica delle Vette, I think there was this really acute awareness that something was changing, and it was changing too rapidly, and it really created a feeling of unease. It created a feeling of unease in day-to-day life, in living and relating with other people, but it also created unease with the possession of knowledge and the fact that the masses now could really access knowledge that previously was not privy to them. So the whole sense of being part of a privileged class in Italy kind of really started feeling shaky at the beginning of the 20th century. So the idea of that everything was progress and the progress was good, and all the ideas related to modernity, I mean, I don't really want to list each and every one because we would go for a 3-hour podcast, but you know exactly what I mean. Everything related to progressive thought, in their eyes, was the inversion of what was real, what was true, and what people should actually strive for. So, I mean, it wasn't just striving for a great past and, oh, you know, we've got to go back and seclude ourselves from the rest of society and live our own life in our little huts in the countryside in the way that our ancestors did. These people were pretty much people who lived in the cities and enjoyed living in the cities, enjoyed the amenities of the cities, but at the same time thought that things were going a bit too fast, a bit too far.
That's interesting, yeah. When you said the word cacophony, of course that relates to music very strongly, and as a musician I was thinking through all you were just saying about modernity and about things going too fast. In the arts, like in occultism, mm-hmm. That movement and that development that goes too fast for many, and those who understand would then throw the non-understanding of the others onto their heads, and in order yeah. to tell them you are not of today. Yeah. We have that in different types of arts, if we want to call it occultism an art as well, which I like to do because I think there are many connection points. So this mm-hmm. is a whole society problem at the time, maybe even till today.
I absolutely agree with you, but at the same time, it's curious because, for example, with Evola, you have his adherence to Dadaism, and people are like, oh, you know, like how does this traditionalist connect with this really avant-garde and crazy movement like Dadaism? Because I mean, it must have been like the craziest thing to happen up to then. You know, seeing Duchamp in a museum, or Tristan Tzara, or anything like that. So the question is, you know, why did Evola actually adhere to that? I think the answer is that what I've written in an article on Evola and Dadaism is that I think that Evola had reached a point in his late teens and early 20s where nothing really made sense anymore. And he was still lost and still kind of looking for the traditionalist ideas that he would develop after that. And he just thought, okay, you know, like if this life is nonsense, if this life doesn't mean anything, then I'm going to be a Dadaist, because that is the epitome of doing something for its own sake and it doesn't have to have a meaning. And if it has a meaning, it's not Dadaism. So a lot of these people tended to gravitate towards these avant-garde movements because there was something that was happening then and there. And Righini was very, very much into the Florentine avant-garde of his day. But at the same time, you can see that he's not fully committed. Even when he writes about his early occultist experiences, like Theosophy, you can tell that he's not found his ground. It's not where he belongs. He's talking about pranayama, he's talking about Eastern influences, and he doesn't write about these things like people such as Aleister Crowley, for example, write about them. Aleister Crowley writes about yoga in a very matter-of-fact way and in a very clear way, and he's very much adamant that this is a very important thing for the man of his day. While Righini is, he's doing it, but that's, he's searching his way. And in the same way, Evola approaches Dadaism in the same way, to find a way out. And I think that both Evola and Righini, and Armentano as well, he was a pianist, he was a composer. I think they all really managed to realize where they stood when they developed the idea of a tradition, of traditionalism. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the same, you can say the same about Guénon and his early years as, well, he was brought up in a Catholic school, and he then went to Paris to continue his very, very conservative studies and pretty much to be a part of accepted society, you know, until he kind of came to terms with the idea of a tradition. And I think that's a breaking point with all of these characters. And once they do come to terms with the idea of a tradition that goes against everything they're living in at the moment, then things become interesting. And then anti-modernism really kind of starts within an occultist milieu.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know about Evola and Dadaism, but there is certainly a link between the esotericists of that time and surrealists.
Also. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Sure, absolutely, absolutely. I think it's like a decade later compared to Evola's Dadaist period, but definitely, I mean, I think it's in the same vein, absolutely. Mm. There's a very, very good book by Tessil Baudouin on surrealism and occultism, which I really recommend to anyone who wants to further their knowledge within the subjects of surrealism, Breton, and occultism.
Chris, as you were discussing traditionalism and the views about it, it occurred to me to ask, because I always assumed these things arose in unison, you know, where someone was both critical of modernity and exalted tradition, but mm-hmm. that may not be the case. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I think that there's always a moment. I mean, if you take any normal kid who goes to high school and who then turns into, I don't know, a goth or a punk, right? There's always a moment before that when he tries to conform with society and he tries to find a place within his peers. And then he reaches a breaking point, and that can be anything, but he reaches a breaking point. And then from then on, he becomes opposite to everything that his peers stand for. And I think that's pretty much what happened. I mean, I don't think you're born a traditionalist. I mean, you can be born with certain ideas, that's fair enough, but I think it's in human nature, or at least it was for these characters, to try, at least at the very beginning, I mean, we're talking late teens for Righini and late teens for Evola, to conform with society, even within like an avant-garde structure, you know. We're not talking about, you know, a conservative, stiff society, you know. We're talking about avant-garde. But even within that, I think these people did not find what they were looking for. And it's only later on, it's only when Righini meets Armentano, for example, that he is made privy to the existence of this world, which is the world of tradition. And after that, but he never looks back. Even when his master has to go to Brazil in order not to be persecuted by the fascist police and everything, he never kind of recants his ideals. And he always sticks for tradition in the same way that Guénon went to Egypt and never came back. And in the same way as Evola really tackled a plethora of subjects, but never really abandoned the idea of tradition. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, I think it does. It's almost, you might say, it could be seen as like a process, maybe a maturation process.
I think so too. I mean, if we want to make the parallel with, I'm always citing Crowley because he's the kind of second main subject of my academic inquiry. But I mean, Crowley had a part where he kind of went the normal, noble, kind of like wealthy Englishman way, you know, going to Cambridge and then joining the Golden Dawn, which was quite daring, but, you know, it wasn't unheard of. But it was afterwards, when he found his own ground, his own ideas about magic, you know, especially sexual magic and everything, that he broke with everything of his past. Mm-hmm. And just stood with that for the rest of his life. I mean, so it's not only traditionalism. I guess it's, you know, when you find your real calling, then you do tend to do that. And that's what Ruggini did. I mean, that's what Armentano did and all the other Roman traditionalists.
Do you have any, I don't know if final thoughts or reflections about your work here? Or are you going to be extending this in new directions, or are you closing this chapter?
Well, the thesis itself is going to come out in printed form early next year. So I'll be sure to let you know when it does. I will definitely carry on this line of inquiry. I'm not sure if I will focus it on the Roman traditionalists. I would definitely like to do more research on the Ur group. Definitely, absolutely. But I would also like to kind of bring together traditionalist thoughts in a way like Mark Sedgwick has already done with his work Against the Modern World. Mm-hmm. But I would like to really bring together all forms of traditional thought. So Islamic traditional thought in, let's say, Sayyid Nasser Hussein or, you know, Guénon, for example, and pagan traditional thought such as Ruggini, for example, and the early Evola, and, you know, Christian traditional thought and Schwann. I would like to focus on the idea of tradition itself by using the most sources I can get my hands on to show how universal it actually is and how it can't be really confined within a small niche of the occult world and even less of the political world or the political spectrum. So that's definitely where I want to go in the future. And also, in a way, I would definitely like to continue bringing Italian forms of occultism and esotericism to an English-speaking audience. I think they're missing out on a great deal of interesting material, which I will definitely endeavor to make available. Like with the translation of Imperialismo Pagano by Ruggini in my dissertation, I think that really is the most important part of the dissertation itself. You can't really understand Ruggini if you don't read Ruggini. And I think translating the whole work, the whole of Imperialismo Pagano, I mean, it's not that long, but I think that gives the reader a greater idea of who Ruggini was than anything else. But I think that applies to every author and every occultist, really.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking forward to your future work, but you deserve a lot of credit for what you've already accomplished here. So, Christian Giudice, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you, and I've learned quite a bit.
The pleasure is mine, Greg. I hope to be here soon talking about other works.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you.
In the Chamber of Reflection at chamberofreflection.com, Christian Giudice, Rudolph, and I continue the interview learning how the Italian occultists deliberately spread their influence through Masonic lodges, utilizing Italian Freemasonry as the vehicle for their traditionalist ideology. Join us for that fascinating and important conversation by joining the membership section at chamberofreflection.com or subscribing via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. And if you're already supporting the show or have done so in the past, my heartfelt thanks, and I salute you. The intro music is Awakening by Paul Avgerinos. The outro music is by Harlan Williams and entitled The Limb of the Fiend. Thanks for listening, and until next time. Thank you.